Welcome to Voter Information, the show that looks at elections in the city, the state, and the nation. This is your election guru, Mark Braun here. Glad you could join us today. And a reminder, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read in AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Okay. So it's going to be national stuff today. No primary results to that are in front of us just yet. So we're going to start off with this one from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, March 23rd, 2026. In far-flung Alaska, voting case stirs anxiety. Late-arriving mail ballots are the norm. Supreme Court will consider changes by Becky Boer. Juneau, Alaska. The tiny Alaska native village of Beaver is about 40 minutes by plane from the nearest city. Its roughly 50 residents rely on weekday flights from mail and many of their basic supplies, including groceries and Amazon deliveries of everyday household items. Air service plays an outsized role in the nation's most expensive state, where most communities rely on flights for year-round access. Planes also play a crucial role in elections, getting voting materials and ballots to and from rural precincts such as Beaver, and delivering ballots for thousands of Alaskans who vote by mail, in some places where in-person voting is not available. The vast distances and relative isolation of so many communities make Alaska unique and are why its residents have a significant interest in arguments taking place Monday before the U.S. Supreme Court. Many here worry that a case from Mississippi challenging whether ballots received after Election Day can be counted in federal elections could end Alaska's practice of accepting late-arriving ballots. Alaska counts ballots if they are postmarked by Election Day and received within 10 days or 15 days for overseas voters in general elections. These processes have been in place for a long time just to ensure that our ballots are counted, said Rhonda Pitka, a poll worker and first chief in Beaver, which sits along the Yukon River, 110 miles north of Fairbanks. If the court decides ballots in all states must be received by Election Day, she said, they'll be disenfranchising thousands of people in these rural communities. It's just basically saying that their votes don't count, and that's a real shame. The Supreme Court will hear arguments as the U.S. Senate is debating legislation being pushed by President Trump that would require people to show proof of citizenship to register to vote, an onerous burden for many, and a photo ID to cast ballots. Most Republicans argue that the bill is necessary to shore up voting integrity, but Democrats and voting rights advocates and Alaska Republican Senator U.S. Lisa Murkowski contend that it amounts to voter suppression. Studies have consistently shown that voting fraud is exceedingly rare in the U.S., and courts have struck down similar measures after finding they prevented eligible voters from casting ballots. Alaska is one of 14 states that allow all mailed ballots postmarked by Election Day to arrive days or weeks later and be counted, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Voting Rights Lab. An additional 15 provide grace periods for military and overseas ballots. But Alaska's geography, weather, and great distances between communities, Alaska is more than twice the size of Texas, the nation's second largest state, raises the stakes for voters. The unusual way the state counts its votes also makes a grace period important, advocates say. Under Alaska's ranked choice system for general elections, workers in small rural precincts call in voters' first choices to a regional election office. All ballots, however, ultimately are flown to the state division of elections in the capital, Juneau. There, they arrive too late for tabulations in Juneau, 50 days after Election Day. If the Supreme Court rules that ballots cannot be counted if they arrive at election offices after Election Day, many Alaska voters could be affected. About 50,000 Alaskans voted by mail in the 2024 presidential election. I think there's probably no other state where this ruling could have a more detrimental impact than ours, Murkowski, her state's senior senator, said in an interview. Murkowski sees the case, a challenge by the Republican National Committee and others to Mississippi allowance of late-arriving ballots, as an effort to end voting by mail statewide. The RNC argues that such grace periods improperly extend elections for federal office, but Mississippi responded that no voting occurs after Election Day, only the delivery and counting of already completed ballots. Taken together, Murkowski said, the Trump-backed voting bill and the Supreme Court case could discourage people from voting. I think we're seeing a level of voter intimidation. I'll just say it, she said. I feel very, very strongly that the effort that we should be making at the federal level is to do all that we can to make our elections accessible, fair, and transparent for every lawful voter out there. Alaska's other congressional members, Representative Nick Begich and Senator Dan Sullivan, both Republican allies of Trump who are seeking re-election this year, support the Save America Act now before the Senate. But they also said they want to ensure that ballots properly cast on or before Election Day get counted. We'll see what the courts choose to do on that issue, but I do think we need to allow for time for ballots to come in from the rural parts of our state, Begich said during a recent visit to Juneau. A court filing in the Mississippi case by Alaska Attorney General Stephen Cox and Solicitor General Jenna Lawrence did not take sides but outlined geographic and logistical challenges to holding elections in Alaska. In Atquasuk, on Alaska's North Slope, poll workers counted votes on election night in 2024 tallies they would normally relay by phone to election division officials. But the filing said they could not get through and choose what they saw as the next best solution. They placed the ballots and tally sheets into a secure package and mailed them to the division, who did not receive them until 9 days later. The filing seeks clarity from the Supreme Court, particularly around what it means for ballots to be received by Election Day. Although it is clear when a ballot is cast, when certain ballots are actually received is open to different interpretations, especially given the connectivity challenges for Alaska's far-flung boroughs, Cox and Lawrence wrote. Lawyers with the Native American Rights Fund and Great Lakes Indigenous Law Center said in filings with the court that limited postal service in rural areas means ballots might not be postmarked until they reach Anchorage or Juneau, which can take days. In the 2022 general election, between 55 and 78% of absentee ballots from the state house district stretching from the Aleutian Islands up to the western coast to the North Slope arrived at an election office after Election Day, they wrote. Statewide, about 20% of absentee ballots in that election were received after Election Day. Requiring ballots to be received by Election Day, they warned, would disproportionately disenfranchise Alaska Native voters. The lawyers represent the National Congress of American Indians, Native Vote Washington, and the Alaska Federation of Natives. Michelle Spark, director of Get Out the Native Vote, a nonpartisan voting rights advocacy group affiliated with the Alaska Federation of Natives, worries about creative confusion and fear among voters. She sees the case before the Supreme Court and the Republican Save Act as a multi-pronged attempt to take control or wrest control of elections away from the states. Alaska, she says, has enough inherent barriers for many voters. There is a minute record of election fraud, not at the rate that requires this heavy-handed response through the legislature and the Supreme Court, she said. That was In Far-Flung Alaska, Voting Case Stirs Anxiety by Becky Bohr, from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Monday, March 23, 2026. Bohr writes for the Associated Press. All right, on to elections in Ohio from the Los Angeles Times, Monday, April 20, 2026. GOP to spin big in Ohio race amid bribery scandal by Julie Carr Smythe. Columbus, Ohio. As he seeks to retain his U.S. Senate seat this fall, Ohio Republican John Husted has been unable to escape the shadow of a $60 million bribery scandal that has roiled state politics for more than 5 years. Husted was recently called to testify as a defense witness in the related criminal trial of two former energy executives, testimony he might have to reprise after a hung jury led to a mistrial in the case in March. A judge in Akron scheduled the retrial to begin September 28, meaning Husted could be back on the witness stand with a week before early voting begins for the November elections. The former lieutenant governor and Ohio Secretary of State has never been charged with or accused of any wrongdoing. But the vast public record that has emerged from the scandal has raised questions about Husted's dealings with key players who have been indicted or imprisoned in the scheme, which revolved around legislative approval of a $1 billion bailout for the state's two nuclear power plants. It's too early to know whether Husted's association with the trial will be a political liability for the first-term senator, who in the fall is expected to face Sherrod Brown, a Democrat ousted from the Senate in 2024. In a potential sign of concern, Senate Republicans' main super political action committee, the Senate Leadership Fund, recently announced plans to spend $79 million on Husted's behalf. That's roughly one quarter of its planned national spending in eight tightly contested Senate races. Asked in 2022 what role he played in the bailout legislation, known as House Bill 6, Husted answered none. He has reiterated that stance many times since, even as evidence disclosed in the case has raised questions about his involvement. Husted's calendars that came to light during the recent trial involving executives for the utility, Akron-based First Energy, showed a number of additional meetings or phone calls that he had with former chief executive Chuck Jones, with the state's former top utility regulator, who has since died, and with then-Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. They formed the triangle of influence at the heart of the scheme as laid out by federal prosecutors. Husted's calendars were obtained by the Ohio Capital Journal through a public records request and have been reviewed by the Associated Press. Jones and First Energy lobbyist Michael Dowling were charged in connection with their alleged roles in the bribery scandal and will be retried in the fall. Householder is serving a 20-year prison sentence after being convicted in 2023 of orchestrating the scheme, which First Energy has admitted to underwriting. The interactions noted in Husted's calendar were around the time the bailout bill was being developed and passed. Evidence presented in various cases showed Jones and Dowling discussing a push by Husted for additional subsidies in the legislation. Husted has consistently denied that he played a role in creating the legislation as well as having any knowledge of criminal activity surrounding the bill. In an NBC4 interview in January, Husted said, "My role was very clear. I wanted the nuclear power plants to remain operational." He said it was about keeping those plants open and keeping the lights on for millions of Ohioans. In June 2019, Jones texted Dowling screenshots of a conversation he had with Householder that suggested Husted was working on First Energy's behalf to extend the term of the nuclear plant subsidies from 6 years to 10 years. Jones urged Householder to negotiate hard for 10 years of subsidies, or he would be forced to revisit the issue again before his speakership ended. Ugh, that added $600 million. Household wrote about an additional amount that has not been previously reported. The bill called for charging Ohio ratepayers $150 million a year in nuclear subsidies. Husted called me two nights ago and was supposed to get it in the Senate version, Jones replied. He's not a legislator, Household replied about Husted, who was by then the lieutenant governor. I know, but he said Senate leaders would listen, Jones replied. He didn't deliver. The texts were a part of evidence gathered in Householder's criminal trial. When Husted has been asked previously about the exchanges, he had been adamant that they do not prove he was part of the deal-making. "I don't know what we're talking about. We weren't involved," Husted said when asked about the texts during an unrelated news conference in 2024. Texts to other people shared amongst themselves. "I have nothing to do with me. And I wasn't involved in that conversation." A longtime Ohio lobbyist told federal agents that First Energy and First Energy Solutions, the subsidiary that owned the nuclear power plants helped by the bailout, funneled dark money to nonprofits that benefited Husted and Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican. According to the notes from his Department of Justice interview obtained by the Associated Press and not previously reported, lobbyist Neil Clark identified one of the groups as Freedom Frontier. This was the group that received a $1 million contribution in 2017 marked internally by First Energy as Husted Campaign. The donation was brought to light through documents filed in a lawsuit by First Energy shareholders and obtained through a records request by Cleveland.com. Husted was a candidate for governor at the time. Dark money refers to political contributions flowing to certain nonprofit organizations whose donors do not have to be publicly identified. Coordinating between those groups and candidate campaigns is generally prohibited by federal law. Internal FirstEnergy communications from 2017 and 18, which is evidence in a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission investigation, include discussions involving Jones, Dowling, and others about attending Husted events as far back as 2016. They also reflect Dowling's concerns about dark money contributions becoming public. Jones and Dowling also discussed the strategies to contribute under alternative names. In July 2018, for instance, as the two were planning a DeWine Husted fundraiser in Naples, Florida, they discussed contributing under one name while covering event costs under another, so there would be no cost billed to the campaign. Husted declined a request for further comment about the details that have emerged as the various cases surrounding the bribery scandal play out. Senator Husted has commented exclusively with the media and given testimony under oath and doesn't have anything additional to add, said Josh Eck, his spokesperson. That was GOP to Spend Big in Ohio Race Amid Bribery Scandal by Julie Carr Smythe from the Los Angeles Times, Monday, April 20, 2026. Smythe writes for the Associated Press. All right, now we've got two articles from the perspective section regarding the Texas Senate race. From the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, May 28, 2026, this first one, Hope Anew for Democratic Dreams in Texas by Mark Z. Baraback, columnist. The catalog of unrequited hopes and hearts is a long one. Captain Ahab went mad in his vengeful search for Moby Dick. Jay Gatsby's ostentatious fortune failed to win the love of Daisy Buchanan. Charlie Brown never kicked the football. Then there's Texas, the land of broken Democratic dreams. It's been half a century since the party carried Texas in a presidential election. The last time Democrats won a statewide office, back in 1994, The Lion King was smashing box office records, Boys to Men ruled the radio, and the World Wide Web was about to change everything. As Texas grew increasingly Republican and politically beyond reach, Democrats insisted every election year was the one when they'd end their futility and take back power in either Washington or Austin, the state capital. It never happened. But is this finally the year? With Ken Paxton stomping incumbent John Cornyn on Tuesday in a fierce and astronomically expensive U.S. Senate primary, many Democrats believe so, and even neutral observers agree they've been handed their best shot at resurrection in a good while. Paxton is going to be a much tougher guy for Republicans to haul over the finish line 5 months from now, as opposed to Cornyn, who never lost an election until this one, said Richard Murray, an emeritus political science professor at the University of Houston who spent decades surveying Texas voters. We're looking at a very expensive, hard-fought race. Paxton, Texas's three-term attorney general, is a singularly flawed candidate. Indicted, impeached, accused by his ex-wife of adultery, the GOP nominee is, to put it mildly, an ethically challenged individual, as the famous, understated, and concerned Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins put it. But Paxton was the choice of President Trump, he too of impeachment, indictment, and adulterous infamy, and that settled that. Trump described Cornyn, a four-term senator and former justice of the Texas Supreme Court, as a good man but insufficiently supportive when times were tough. Among those occasions of abandonment, Cornyn voted to certify the incontrovertible result of the 2020 presidential election, thwarting Trump's bid to illegally stay in office. The Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate is James Tallarico, 37, a state representative from Austin and a Presbyterian seminarian and former public school teacher who's built a nationwide following with his articulate and scriptural takedown of Republican foes. Imagine Beto O'Rourke with a clerical collar and capacity to mint money. In 2018, O'Rourke came from seemingly nowhere and nearly upset Republican Ted Cruz in the closest Texas Senate race in decades. But before that, it was the filibustering Wendy Davis who fired up Democratic imaginations nationwide. She commandeered the floor of the state Senate to briefly block anti-abortion legislation. This is the year, before failing well short in a 2014 bid for governor. The key difference this time, with all due credit to Tallarico and his protege's fundraising, is his damaged goods opponent. Normally, all it takes to win in Texas is a Republican with an R beside a candidate's name. But polling suggests a not insignificant number of GOP voters could have a hard time supporting Paxton, which doesn't necessarily mean they'll back Tallarico. They may simply not vote in the Senate race, which could be nearly as costly. The counter-argument is that Paxton, a martyred hero to the MAGA movement, could boost turnout among the party base at a time Trump is leaking support within the establishment GOP. Either way, the president's me-first political self-indulgence is not making things any easier for his fellow Republicans as they fight to hang on to control of the House and Senate in November. In the 2022 midterm election, Trump boosted a batch of unappealing misfits, their sole attribute being their fealty to him, with poor results. Republicans lost eminent winnable Senate contests in Arizona, Georgia, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania, and with it their chance at control of the chamber. Even if Paxton prevails in November, Trump's endorsement could prove quite costly to the GOP, and not just in figurative sense. Democrats need a gain of 4 seats to flip the Senate. To do so, they must successfully defend seats in Georgia, Michigan, Minnesota, and New Hampshire, and then pick up at least 4 others from a menu that includes Alaska, Iowa, Maine, Montana, Nebraska, North Carolina, Ohio, and now Texas. It's a considerable reach, but Democratic chances look a lot better than they did just a few months ago before Trump mired the country in an Iranian quagmire and the price of gas and just about everything else began to sail through the ceiling. Holding onto Cornyn's seat will end up costing Republicans a kingly sum, money that can't be spent in 2 places at the same time, as Matt Mikowiak, a longtime Texas GOP strategist and advertiser to Cornyn's campaign, noted. It can go to either Michigan, New Hampshire, Georgia, Iowa, Alaska, or it can go here to Texas, which is extremely expensive. Odds are against Tallarico and Democrats winning the Senate race in November because Texas remains fundamentally a Republican and conservative-leaning state. Paxton may win for that reason and that reason alone. This is as good an environment as Democrats are going to get realistically, said Jim Henson, head of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas in Austin, who's witnessed many highly touted Democrats fall to in a blaze of unwarranted hype. But when you start doing the math, it's a little bit hard to see it all adding up, which is not to say it can't happen. Truth, as the saying goes, can be stranger than Moby Dick or any other fiction. That was Hope Anew for Democratic Dreams in Texas by Mark Z. Baraback, columnist. And this next one is Cornyn's Attempts to Mollify Trump Proved Futile. The Texas senator is still ousted in Republican primary by President's candidate Paxton by Thomas Beaumont and Jesse Bedane. Plano, Texas. As it turned out, it would never be enough. U.S. Senator John Cornyn tried for more than a year to show President Trump and Texas Republicans that he and the president were on the same team. Cornyn posted a photo of himself reading Trump's Art of the Deal. He proposed legislation to rename a stretch of interstate in Trump's honor. Perhaps most glaringly, the Senate institutionalist who long supported the filibuster reversed his position in a failed effort to advance voting restrictions that are a priority for the president. None of it worked. On Tuesday, Cornyn became the latest in a line of Republicans who lost their primaries after falling out of favor with a president with little tolerance for dissent and a seemingly insatiable appetite for retribution. The 4-term senator lost by double digits to Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who Trump endorsed last week as a true MAGA warrior. Cornyn, on the other hand, was very disloyal to me, Trump wrote on social media. Trump's intervention in the Texas runoff came after weeks of successfully backing primary challengers in Indiana, Louisiana, and Kentucky as revenge against incumbents who broke with his agenda. Cornyn's attempt to avoid the same fate made even some of his supporters wince. You look at the positions he took to please the president and the groveling and whatever, said former Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, a Republican and Trump critic who didn't seek re-election during the president's first midterm in 2018. It was rather painful to watch. Trump took an uncommonly equanimous approach to Tuesday's results the following morning. Congratulations to Ken Paxton on such a tremendous win and to John Cornyn for having run a strong and powerful race, but more importantly, having had a truly great career, he wrote on social media. John will remain my friend for a long time to come as we both watch Ken become a fantastic common sense senator, one who is respected by all. Cornyn's loss wasn't for a lack of political gymnastics and astronomical campaign spending. His campaign began running an advertisement last summer, part of an astoundingly $100 million air war by the senator and allied groups, with Cornyn looking into the camera and saying, "I voted with President Trump 99% of the time." On Cornyn's campaign homepage, Trump and Cornyn stand side by side with thumbs pointed upward and an image aimed at projecting solidarity. Deeper in the website, the category titled The Trump-Cornyn Record notes the senator's role securing votes for Trump's signature 2017 tax cut bill. Cornyn has also been championing provisions in Trump's signature tax and spend legislation to finance work on the U.S.-Mexico border wall. The senator had dismissed the project as naive during Trump's 2016 campaign. But in January, he stood along a section of completed wall in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, touting the measure's $11 billion for Texas contractors' work at the direction of the President of the United States, to whom I am very grateful. Cornyn's praise for his party's leader and president were not unusual, but they clashed with the statement Cornyn made in May 2023, when Trump was mounting his presidential comeback campaign. "Trump's time has passed him by," he told reporters. "I don't think President Trump understands that when you run in a general election, you have to appeal to voters beyond your base." Trump would go on to easily win the nomination and carry every battleground state in the general election. Cornyn would hew closely to the president for the first 16 months of his second administration, hoping at the outside chance of his endorsement or to keeping him from weighing in at all. But Trump did not forget the past slights. "John Cornyn is a good man, and I worked well with him, but he was not supportive of me when times were tough," he wrote on social media while endorsing Paxton. Cornyn has playfully worked to promote Trump fandom, last year posting a picture on social media of himself thoughtfully peering into the pages of Trump's 1987 memoir and business advice, The Art of the Deal. In a more obvious gesture, he proposed designating a section of a U.S. highway from the Texas Gulf Coast to Montana as Interstate 47 to honor a 47th president with a well-documented love of naming things after himself. In a news release about the proposal filed just over 2 weeks before Tuesday's runoff, Cornyn said it would be known as the Trump Interstate. The more tectonic shift occurred in March after Trump had teased a possible endorsement of either Cornyn or Paxton in the runoff. Paxton swiftly said he would consider dropping his candidacy if the Republican-controlled Senate lifted the filibuster and passed the Save America Act, a series of voting restrictions that Trump has described as an essential part of his agenda. The following week, Cornyn wrote an op-ed in the New York Post, Trump's favorite hometown newspaper, backing away from his previous support of the filibuster. He vowed to support whatever changes to Senate rules that may prove necessary to get the bill through the Senate and on the president's desk for his signature. Flake watched with unease. "I know John and his long-held positions on the filibuster and the Senate's institution," he said. "No office is worth that." That was Cornyn's attempts to mollify Trump prove futile, by Thomas Beaumont and Jesse Bedane, Beaumont and Bedane write for the Associated Press. Bedane, reporter from San Antonio, AP writer Mary Claire Jelinek in Washington contributed to this report, and both of those are from the Perspective section of the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, May 28, 2026. And now we've got two articles from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times, Thursday, June 11, 2026. Trump backs Collins in Maine. Despite friction, president supports her in fight with Democrat Plattner, by Patrick Whittle and Will Weissert. Washington. This election year is deja vu for Senator Susan Collins, the main Republican running for re-election, as Democrats pin their hopes on a new candidate to topple her. Last time, it was state lawmaker Sarah Gideon. This time, it is combat veteran and oyster farmer Graham Plattner. Collins has proved to be a hard target for Democrats, even in the case of candidates without the baggage of Plattner, who has faced criticism for his relationships with women, for his inflammatory online posts, and for a previous tattoo recognized as a Nazi symbol. Collins is also the rare Republican these days who can sometimes boost her own popularity back home by keeping her distance from President Trump. She has perfected that delicate dance over the years, even as Trump has sharply criticized her and tightened his grip on the party, costing two of Collins' colleagues their chance of re-election. However, on Wednesday, however, Trump made clear he is in Collins' corner. Although the president told reporters Wednesday that she's not my best friend at all, he also said that she's a sane person and she's a person that never missed a vote in many years. Collins recently set a record by casting her 10,000th Senate vote in a row. Trump suggested Plattner is worse than any human being that's run for office, probably, and went on to insult the Democratic nominee. He's a cheap, no-good person, the president said. With the November general election months away, it's uncertain whether Trump's support for Collins will help or hurt her as she seeks a sixth term. Years of practice have made her adept at staying close, but not too close, to the president when it is politically advantageous, and moving away, showing an independent streak, is helpful. She's shown time and time again where her state's electorate is. She understands what's too far. She understands where she needs to be, said Republican political consultant Mac Makowiak. The Democrats need to flip four seats to take control of the Senate. They hope Trump's falling approval ratings and the war with Iran, as well as the fallout on oil prices and the economy, could buy you their chance. Maine is among the top targets, along with Alaska, Ohio, and North Carolina. Plattner wants to make the case that Collins is not as independent of Trump as her reputation suggests. He often notes that she allowed his Supreme Court nominees to go through, which in 2022 led to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that had legalized abortion. Susan Collins may have started her career decades ago in Washington with good intentions, but she has become just as spineless and corrupt as the establishment she now serves, Plattner said at a party celebrating his primary victory. Plattner supporters are ready for change, said John Keenan of Sullivan, Maine. I think Maine has grown tired of the same old system, he said, and putting youth into the campaign instead of a rubber stamp is very refreshing. The National Republican Senatorial Committee posted a pro-Collins video on X that resembled a 1980s video game. It said Collins has brought more than $1.5 billion back to Maine, and Plattner spent time as a kid at a $70,000 a year prep school in Connecticut. Collins may still have to stay wary of Trump, who has singled her out for daring to occasionally defy him on some issues. For example, she voted last week with Democrats to block the nearly $1.8 billion fund the president wanted to create to benefit allies that he claims were unfairly targeted by law enforcement. Nonetheless, he has refrained from criticizing her lately, especially as the senator failed to draw a credible GOP challenger and Cruz in the primary. Political advisors close to Trump said the president understands how crucial it is that Republicans maintain control of Congress, and that requires accommodating Collins. Trump understands the need to avoid a Republican wipeout like the 2018 midterms, when Democrats flipped the House and derailed much of the final 2 years of his first-term plans. Collins represents the people of Maine first and foremost, and has proven herself to be a dedicated public servant, Republican National Committee spokesperson Kristen Chiansi said in a statement. Collins spokesperson Blake Kiernan said the senator has worked with five different presidents throughout her Senate tenure and has never agreed with any of them on everything. When she agrees with an effort, she will support it. When she disagrees, she does not hesitate to speak up for what she believes is the right outcome for Maine and for America, Kiernan said in a statement. Senator John Cornyn of Texas was among his party's top voices, but Trump viewed him as insufficiently loyal. State Attorney General Paxton trounced Cornyn in a runoff on May 26, just days after receiving Trump's endorsement. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana voted to convict Trump during his impeachment trial after the Capitol siege on January 6, 2021. Cassidy lost his primary when Trump endorsed Representative Juliet Letlow and State Treasurer Dunn Fleming and Vance to a runoff later this month. "She's always down in the polls, and she survives," Trump said when asked about Collins in an interview with the New York Post last week. Collins defeated Gideon, the Maine House Speaker, by almost 9 percentage points in 2020, the same year that Democrat Joe Biden beat Trump by a similar margin in the state. Mikowiak said there's just no pathway to a MAGA senator from Maine, referring to Trump's Make America Great Again movement. It does appear that the Trump political operation is soberly analyzing the electoral environment in Maine and really kind of follows her lead as it relates to that state and that race, particularly this cycle, he said. Chuck Ellis, a Republican from Westbrook, Maine, who runs a digital marketing company, said Collins' reluctance to move in lockstep with Trump can be a plus. "Although there are some hardline voters who may disapprove," Ellis said, "ultimately, a lot of your conservatives, your Republicans, are people who are a bit more pragmatic." Trump is unlikely to travel to Maine before November, despite visiting other states with key Senate races such as Iowa and Michigan. Vice President J.D. Vance has been to Maine, where he promoted his anti-fraud task force. Collins did not attend Vance's speech in Bangor last month, where he acknowledged the senator's distance from the Trump administration. "If she was as partisan as I sometimes wish that she was," Vance said, "she would not be a good fit for the people of Maine." That was Trump back Collins in Maine by Patrick Whittle and Will Weissert. Whittle and Weissert write for the Associated Press. Weissert reported from Washington. And now this other article, "Macy's Future Murky After Loss" by Jeffrey Collins and Meg Kinnard. Columbia, South Carolina. After a decade of rolling South Carolina and national politics, Representative Nancy Mace finished a distant fifth in her state's Republican primary for governor, leaving an uncertain future for one of the nation's unabashed politicians. Her campaign mirrored her whipsaw career. Mace courted the support of President Trump in harshly criticizing him over the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. She emphasized her fights with other Republicans to release files from the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. In the final days before Tuesday's primary, she called for a law to prevent anyone not born in the United States from holding political office or serving as a judge. She suggested that Rahm Reddy, another candidate for governor, wasn't qualified because he was a naturalized citizen whose mother was from India and father from Italy. "I didn't come out of a slum in India," Mace said during an appearance in Greenville County this month. "I am born and made here in America." By the end of her campaign, she was making only sporadic public appearances. She struggled to raise money and had no presence on television. Mace mostly communicated through social media, a place she has used to her advantage since being first elected to the South Carolina House in 2017. In a lengthy statement posted after her loss, Mace recounted her achievements in the U.S. House, saying she had taken on the rich and powerful in both parties and voted to release the Epstein files and lost some support for that. Four congressional Republicans were part of the initial group pushing for a discharge petition forcing the files release. Mace and Representative Thomas Massie lost their races, and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene resigned in January. Mace didn't give an indication of her plans in her concession speech Tuesday night. She's backing Alan Wilson in the runoff for governor. Wilson will face Lieutenant Governor Pamela Evett in the runoff on June 23rd. Evett received Trump's endorsement, spurring Mace to lash out on social media. After her political career began in the South Carolina House, Mace received wide praise from Republicans in 2020 for winning back a U.S. House seat around Charleston that had flipped to Democrat for one term. "For those folks that are out there today that maybe weren't with us yesterday, I'm asking for a chance to prove to you that I will be a compassionate leader, a good listener, and an independent thinker," Mace said then. That was Mace's Future Murky After Loss by Jeffrey Collins and Meg Kinnard. Collins and Kinnard write for the Associated Press. Kinnard reported from Washington. AP writer Bill Barrow contributed from Atlanta. And those are both from the Nation section of the Los Angeles Times for Thursday, June 11, 2026. And folks, it looks like we're about to come to the end of another edition of Voter Information. Keep it right here for every election and candidate right here in the city, the state, and the nation. Until next time, everybody, this is your election guru, Mark Braun, saying to you, happy voting and, of course, peace. See you next week, everybody. Have a good week.